to PCMC. That stands for Pop Culture Man Children. That sounds like a toxic name. I know, but don't worry. It's not all men, and men is not a big part of it.
But it is all children.
It is all. No, no, please stay tuned. It's not that. It is a podcast about fandom and movies and comic books and video games and stand-up comedy and TV and all sorts of the stuff that keeps the demons away, really. The stuff that, you know, I like to think of it as the stuff that was your lifeline when I was like, or my lifeline when I was like a 13-year-old nerd. And
oh, yeah.
I didn't know anything about the world. I didn't know to wear deodorant and no one would, you know, I didn't have a lot of friends, but I did have the Thunderbirds.
Sure.
I did have Star Wars waiting for me at home and, you know. That was my friend. The lifeline. That's the, you know.
That's what it should be called. The lifeline.
The lifeline. It is, right? You were, I mean, you're probably more popular than me, but you were,
sure, as a nerd.
Nerdy kid, yeah. Right? I'm sure there was part of you that's like, oh, I'm here with my books. Like, this is my happy place. Oh,
absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. When you have reading memories, mm-hmm. you're a nerd. Yeah.
Like, damn, that was a good
read. That was a good read. Oh, man. I remember reading that book. Yeah. Holy shit. Yeah. I was just telling this to Bill the other day. I was like, reading Goblet of Fire was one of my best reads ever. Because mm-hmm. I just came back from a family vacation at the Atlantis Bahamas. And the book was waiting for me. And this is like pre-Amazon era where you'd have like a package on your doorstep every day. It was like a special package had arrived. And I'm sure my parents were blessed that day that I was not in their face or asking them for anything because I went to my room and I read that book all damn day.
I heard a good read story recently from Jen's aunt. Mm. She's retired now, but when she was working, she would she worked in the city and she would take the train. And the day the last Harry Potter book came out.
Okay.
She was reading it on the train and so was someone else. And the other person like looked at her and was like, this is fucking awesome, isn't it?
Isn't that a great moment on the train when you see somebody else reading your book and you're like,
and it's like, wow, this so is good. Happening. So, but we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about today's episode's topic is best monologues.
Oh, I could monologue about reading, but I won't.
I really hope you don't. Now, let's start off by kind of defining what this is because
is there an earthquake?
I'm gonna I shake my leg a lot. It's just part of my anxiety.
Good.
I don't know if I know what a monologue is because
I don't think you do.
Some of these have other people talking.
Some of these are not monologues, my friend.
Yeah, no. I
watched a couple and I was like, sir, you have dialogue going back and forth. Now, for instance, I sent you one where there's a little bit of dialogue right at the beginning, and then it just kind of goes.
One for sure has dialogue, but the one person is speaking a lot and saying these eloquent things, and then someone else will say something that prompts them.
Yes,
and they keep going.
I think any bit of it. Yes. Could be considered a monologue.
Yeah, right.
Because one of mine is only 42 or 48 words.
Yeah,
it's so short. So. And that's considered a monologue. So, you know, I think any piece could be broken down.
Yeah.
In that one that I was like, what's all this dialogue? When did they get in the monologue?
You were like, I send you silent movies and you're like, oh, Mike is so stupid.
He does not
understand any of what this is. So we both did 5.
Yes.
You let me take the obvious one.
Well, that was so in
because
your
it was also my suggestion.
It was like, you were like this.
Whenever I...
Which little, is also my favorite film, so I
a
like,
little
okay.
Look behind the scenes. Often when we come up with an episode idea, you'll put like I.E. an example of it. So I think I wrote like best monologues, I.E. Quint from Jaws. So we both had it, and then you were like, you could have it. So I have it. We should start with it.
Even though it's
the best.
It's the best.
It's the greatest.
It's the best.
This is,
and I told you, it's also the one I quote the most in my personal life. Yeah. Which you would think, how is a story about the sinking of the Indianapolis something you can quote in your personal
What's
life?
What's crazy is it's,
but I do.
It's a real history lesson in a fictional story.
It is.
Like that all happened.
Yeah,
and it's such a moment because
it's the scariest moment in the whole movie. And it does not, it's just a man talking.
And it's punctuated by the shark attacking. Like the
at
boom.
At the end, yeah.
Like you go the right shark, into it.
Yeah.
And it's so great because you've got the three guys on the boat and they're like showing their scars and then fucking...
And they're drinking.
Chief Brody has this stupid fucking appendix scar that he's embarrassed about. And they're drinking, yeah. And then he tells a story where it's like he earns Hooper's respect.
Right, because he and Hooper are at odds this whole time. Right, right. And then because of the class difference. The Indianapolis mentioned. And Hooper's like, you were on the Indianapolis? And he realizes who the fuck he's dealing with.
Yeah. And this guy's fucking... I mean, and it's just... it's. And Robert Shaw is incredible.
It's an amazing performance.
The way he is like throwing it away, but also he's obviously talking about the most traumatic thing that's ever happened to him. And he's like, on the third day, I bumped into a friend of mine and he'd been bitten in half. It's like, fuck. It's also deep too, because what they had done was their mission was to deliver the bomb.
The bomb. The Hiroshima, which is like the worst Hiroshima thing that ever happened. Bomb. Yeah, he keeps saying like we delivered. Anyway, and he caps it off. So he gives the details of the journey and then he says like we were delivering the bomb. And then he goes into how like the ship sank. Yeah. They were all attacked by sharks. It's horrible situation.
It was so top secret they didn't even call us overdue for a week.
And then he ends the whole thing with like, anyway, we delivered the bomb.
Right, he did the job.
Yeah.
But
it's almost like, they deserved it.
Yeah, like fate
for what
is,
they did.
Yeah, yeah.
Or that this is now the retribution because he survived.
That's where Quint is like Captain Ahab. Nemo.
Nemo. Yeah. Okay, either one. You know, these great captains, they deserve what they get.
But no, I think I was thinking about
Ahab. Yes. This is fate.
Right, this like, is come together.
This
him.
Is fated. This is destined.
He was going to die this way.
He
was always
going to
die this
by
way.
A shark. Yeah. And whether it was there or here, they're going to get him.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a real, I did a whole, like a report, like a book report. I did a whole paper about how Calvinist predetermination is basically like the whole thing about Moby Dick. Or not the whole thing, but one of the major driving forces about how like you are going to die the way you're going to die. And ain't nothing you're going to do is going to change that. And that is something that really comes through in this speech.
Yeah.
And also it like changes the dynamic of the group.
It
changes the emphasis of like this is a random shark to like this has always been what's gonna happen. Yeah. Like
it holds the movie to a stop, but not in a bad way.
Not in a bad way.
In like a great way. It becomes this like soliloquy in the middle.
He was not nominated for an Academy Award.
Bullshit.
I feel like he should have won.
But I think
let alone been nominated.
But I think there's a mistake in it. I told you today.
The date was wrong, right?
No.
Oh. Because I heard it's July 30th, not June the 29th.
No, not even that.
Okay.
Hooper says, what is that? Pointing to his tattoo. And he says to Hooper, that's the Indianapolis. Which makes me think the script said, parentheses, to Hooper, this is the Indianapolis. And he memorized the stage direction. Because that's not what a human does. Why would he go to Hooper while talking to Hooper?
Yeah.
I would never go to Janine.
Right.
Can I have a glass of water?
Unless you're being very
strange. For years, I was like,
that he memorized the stage direction?
Yeah. Okay. That makes gotta sense. Be what it is. Have you ever seen the Hercules episode or the clip of Hercules with, who's the guy who played Hercules?
Kevin Sorbo?
Yeah. Where he's like, the script said annoyed scream, but he just goes, annoyed! Because he's an idiot. it's like that.
That's
but
so
somehow he still
Hooper.
Makes it work.
Yeah,
it's still incredible.
It seems natural because he's a drunk weirdo. Yeah.
To Hooper.
To Hooper.
Right. He's just saying the stage direction.
Yeah.
And I bet he didn't. I don't know this for a fact, but I bet he did that once or twice. And it was like,
been so drunk the day before that they couldn't use it.
Yeah.
And I think this was just such a dynamite read. And apparently Richard Dreyfuss really hated him.
Which is great.
Yeah, but
they really had that relationship.
They really had that animosity towards each other. But I just think it's so funny. He's some things I don't even understand when he's saying them. He's like kind of like you see in a battle in like a calendar battle.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay. Or the thing I quote
frequently
is lifeless eyes, black eyes, like a doll's eyes. And I say it like when you
over white.
Like when you start eating something that is like really like yeah. you're really going crazy eating something. I'm like, oh, you got black eyes, like a doll's eyes. Or just like he's gone crazy. Like I'm like, oh, he's got black eyes, like a doll's eyes.
Yeah, like a doll's eyes. Can you imagine that happened to him and then he went and got a tattoo for it?
Or did he get the tattoo when he started working on the Indianapolis? He might have been on it for a while.
I don't know.
Maybe they jumped in on port and they're like, hey, give me the tattoo. And now it's like, now you're stuck with the worst thing that's ever happened to you.
It's crazy. And then he became a shark.
Yeah. Or I just love that he's like, I'll never put on a life jacket again. I'm like, that's what you took from this?
That's the takeaway. You can also, by the way.
Not like I'm moving to the desert. Yeah. Like, I'm never going to go near the ocean again.
I think we could also put on this list his introduction when he in the meeting where he's like,
I'll catch him. I'll kill him. I don't think that's funny. I don't think that's funny at all.
Yeah.
That's me. I love her.
I'll find him for 10. But I'll catch him. I'll give you the fin, the whole damn thing. Too many fishermen on this island.
He's would I? An apple. You better believe it.
Oh, boy.
Would I catch crabs as well? Oh, certainly.
I finally saw The Sting with Robert Redford and Paul Newman, and him as the villain.
Okay.
And he's so good as like this Irish gangster.
Yeah.
Like there's a one, you ever see that movie?
No.
There's a part where like somebody's like, what do we do to this guy who stole money from you? And he's like, you see that guy over there? That's my best friend. He was the fucking, I grew up with him. He was, best man at my wedding. I'd fucking murder him if he stole from me. And I love him. He's so good in it. He's so scary in it. He's such a scary, intimidating man.
He's a really scary guy.
Yeah.
I don't think he'd be pleasant to be around.
Oh, no. No, no, no. But he's absolutely pleasant.
He's wonderful to watch though. Yeah. He's captivating. He really gets you.
So that's
Quint. Quint for you.
And we should say that Jaws, the screenplay of Jaws was written by Carl Gottlieb.
Who?
Carl Gottlieb.
Oh, he right.
wrote. I want to say who the writers are of these.
Of these monologues. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Was there any improvisation, or he's like an old school stick to the script actor?
I think he stuck so much to the script that he read the stage direction.
Read the stage direction. Yeah, you're right.
He's like, exterior. Day. Turn to Hooper. They just had to cut most of that out.
Oh my god, that's great. I love that. So okay, you started with your most iconic. I'm gonna start with my most iconic.
Sure.
Tears in the Rain.
Yeah.
From Blade Runner. The director's cut? No, just the regular.
Yeah.
Or the director's cut. They didn't change it. So this is from the film Blade Runner. It is spoken by the character Roy Batty, who is played by Rutger Hauer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a Blade Runner fangirl, but I love sci-fi, and I think it's a really like interesting piece of sci-fi.
Right.
And this monologue is extremely brief, and it's so iconic, it has its own Wikipedia page.
Wow.
This monologue. And it's filled with all this really interesting information. So
when we talked about this episode, I should say, I was like, oh, we should read them. And you were like, oh, I don't want to read them. But I think some of it, it's worth reading a little bit of it.
A little bit of
some
it.
Some of this language is incredible.
This particular, the thing I love about it is a beautiful piece of short science fiction.
Yeah.
In a few lines. And I think that's.
It's so invocative. It's so. Illustrative, like you imagine all the shit he's
all these
saying.
Things in a moment, right? So he's dying, he's reached the end of his life. He's a replicant,
they have very short
lives, but they're extremely powerful, and they use them as slaves.
Yeah.
They use them as a workforce, essentially, because they can survive space, they can survive a lot of different things. So he doesn't want to die. This whole movie he's been wanting to live, and throughout the film he's proven time and time again that he's the most human of the characters, despite being a replicant. And this, his dying speech sort of proves that. So he, in his last act, he saves Deckard, who's played by Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
And he says this to him as he's like essentially like crouched over and running out of time. And he says, I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. sea beams. What are sea beams?
Yeah.
Sea beams glittering in the dark by the Tannhauser Gate. Like, what is any of this?
What is all what of this is gobbledygook? Any of
this? And then he's like, all these moments will be lost in time.
Right. Yeah.
Like tears in the rain.
And it's raining.
And then he says, time to die. And then the Vangelis score is playing. Yeah. A dove flies away as he dies. And it's just this beautiful, beautiful moment. And it's written by David Peoples. But David Peoples and Ridley Scott both confirmed that Rutger Hauer did his own thing with this.
Sure.
Came up with Tears in Rain.
Nice.
He added that himself. He said he put a knife to it, that he loved the sci-fi writing, but he wanted to make it more brief. And more, I don't know, not more emotional, I guess.
Yeah.
So he added the Tears in Rain line. And I just think it's just a beautiful little piece of sci-fi.
Yeah.
I really do. I love this speech. And yeah. I love it more than I love the movie as a whole.
Yeah, I surprisingly to some people, I don't like this movie. Mm-hmm. I always found it, I'm sad to say, I always found it boring.
I agree with you. And I think there's boring parts, for sure.
I took a class on cyborgs in grad school, cyborgs in literature. That's also when I read Frankenstein for the first time.
Wow,
and I read the book that it's based on, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, by Philip K. Dick, and I loved it.
Yeah.
And so I was like, let me watch it again, and it made me dislike it more because it's like, wow, you really like... Just to like make it a
I think I watched it with you for the first time.
Oh yeah,
because it was when the director's cut came out.
Yeah, just to make it a film noir. Like I don't know, I'm not a big fan of Ridley Scott. I think all he understands is style, and there's no substance to what he does. So I don't like the movie, but I do like this. Have you ever heard the Patton Oswalt? In his stand up when his daughter was born, he was talking about like, I'm afraid that I won't be a good father because I don't know anything. I'm not smart enough to be a dad. And he's like, what if my daughter's choking? And they're like, can you do anything? And I'm like, I could do the speech from
Blade Runner.
It's like, she's choking. I have seen things you people can't. Oh, she's dead.
Oh, she died. Oh, no. Well, something interesting / weird about this speech is it inspired David Peoples to include a mention of the Tannhauser Gate in the Kurt Russell film Soldier, which he believes is set in the same universe as Blade Runner.
Sure.
And in it, Kurt Russell's character fought at the Battle of Tannhauser Gate.
Incredible.
So, and that's just directly from Blade Runner. And Tannhauser is a Germanic knight and poet whom Robert? Who's the operatic composer of Wagner? Is it Richard? Wagner, I think. He wrote an opera about Tannhauser. Okay. So that's where this name comes from. It's just a weird, interesting name. So anyway, Tears in the Rain. Love it.
That's incredible.
I think it's stronger than the whole. I think this piece is stronger than the whole. Whereas I think.
Yes, I agree.
I think the Quint monologue is the strongest part of an already like amazing movie.
Like an incredible movie.
Yeah.
Well, like any frame, if you're to show me any frame of Blade Runner, I'm like, that's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
it's so good. But it
looks great
to me. It doesn't hold. It's just incredible style.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what order I want to go in. I'll do the Doctor Who one.
Okay.
So this is from
Doctor Who's got a lot of monologues.
There's a lot to pick from here.
Yeah.
So this is Doctor Who season 9. Episode 8. This
one also has a lot of, but it's again, it's like he says so much.
Yeah. It's called it's a two-part episode. The first part is called the Zygon Invasion, and the second part is called the Zygon Inversion.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, so Zygons are characters, aliens in Doctor Who, that can shapeshift to look like people. And they'll take you and they'll put you in a pod. And they'll, like, while you're in there, they can be you and, like, access your memories and stuff.
Mm.
And it's coming off of the events that happened in the 50th anniversary special where the Zygons came and blah, blah, blah. And there's a character in it who works for UNIT, which is, like, the secret alien police in Doctor Who.
Okay.
And her name is Osgood. And in the 50th anniversary special, a Zygon replicates itself to be her. And then the Doctor brokers this peace. So in this episode, which is like a few years later, the Osgoods live together like twins, and they also don't tell people which is which. Whenever they go, are you the human or the Zygon? They go, we are both Osgood, and we represent the peace between the two people. So there's like a splinter cell of Zygons that like want to live completely out and like be their alien selves and, you know, all this shit. So in the Doctor creates this thing called the Osgood Box, which is like a way of undoing the peace treaty. But really it's two boxes. And at the end, you've got the Zygon in one box and then Keith Bishop, a good person, on a good human on the other box. And they both have two buttons. I know this is very complicated. So the Zygon's box has two buttons. And one button will reveal all the Zygons in the world. Their human form will go away and they'll look like Zygons, which are like big scaly monsters. The other button will make it so Zygons can never change ever again. And they're stuck as humans. The other box, there's four buttons here. The other box where the human is, one button will kill all the Zygons in the world, and the other will kill them where they are right then and like blow them all up.
Oh.
And they don't know which button's which, and he won't tell them. And they're kind of like playing chicken with each other. And he goes on this eloquent thing where they're like, what is the point of this? Why? What is the point of this game? And he's like, it's not a game. This is a scale model of war. Because it's actually even longer than the clip I showed you, because in the beginning he's talking to the Zygon and he's like, so what do you want? And she's like, we want to be free and rule the world. We should rule the world. And he goes, okay, what about that? What about after that? Will your world have police? Will there be music?
Right.
Will people go to school? What does this world look like? And then he's like, no one ever thinks it through. And then he's like, I get it. You're so angry. But what happens after? And then what happens after that? And then he's like, you know, in the end, what happens is, you know, what are you going to do when you have your perfect little world and then someone like you wants to disrupt it and kill you? And then it just keeps happening. What are you going to do then? And he's like, in the end, you're going to do what you always had to do, which was sit down and talk to each other. And he gets, and one of my favorite things, because I think Peter Capaldi was a great doctor, and I think he's an underrated doctor, and he could weave humor in with sincerity, and he's like giving this big long speech, and the Zygon's like, why are you still talking? And he's like, because I'm trying to convince you, and I think I'm almost there. And he gets them both to like put the boxes down and not do it. And then in the end, the Doctor like goes to erase all their memory. And she's like, you know, what if this happens again? And he's like, this is the 15th time this has happened.
Oh, my God.
You know, like you said, Doctor Who is full of great speeches. And a lot of them are very boastful. And some are sort of kind of like, you know, like this, like maudlin. But I really like this idea of like, this is what war is. Like, really just being like, war is, it's not just like, it's not sort of a hippie idea of like, war is bad, man. Like, it's really like, war is dumb. Like, war is
utterly pointless. You're going to have to do a treaty eventually anyway. No one ever wins outright.
And then they rule forever. Like, right. That doesn't happen. Yeah. It doesn't work like that. Like, all you're doing is creating more pain and prolonging the inevitable.
Right. So he's like, let's skip to the part where we just do this.
Yeah. Just do the part where we talk to each other. Why can't we talk to each other? And another good part is where he's like, you can walk away right now. And she's like, they won't let me walk away. And he's like, oh, you petulant children. You always think no one will forgive you. Well, I forgive you.
That part. Yeah. He's like, I forgive you. He gets like teary-eyed. Yeah. He's like, I forgive you for everything you did. Now, I don't know the context of this. I was like, oh, I like that part.
Yeah. And she's like, you don't understand. He's like, I don't understand.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, I've been in a war bigger than any war you've ever seen. I've killed more people than you know. When I close my eyes, I hear more screaming. Do we ever
see that in the course of Doctor Who?
Because
like the John Hurt episodes is like him in the midst of the war.
Right. We just know. Right. And we know that, the 50th anniversary, he rewrites it, but he did like push a button and kill all of the Time Lords. So, yeah. And I like whenever they get into the sort of like the Doctor's PTSD of like,
right,
having killed people, you know, for peace. Like, how many people you have to, like, why do people always have to die for there to be nonviolence? So that's Doctor Who.
All right.
A little bit of a dialogue. There's a few people have some lines.
So my next one is not as iconic, but perhaps spoken by someone more iconic.
Uh-huh.
And this is the Meryl Streep stuff.
Yes.
Monologue from Devil Wears Prada.
Yes.
It's a film I've seen once in its entirety.
Interesting.
I've watched this monologue on YouTube many times.
Yes.
When I watched the movie for the first time, I was floored by this. I was like, oh, this is so good. This is so good. It does so many things. So in this scene, Andy, who's played by Anne Hathaway, is coming to work for, you know, like a Vogue adjacent magazine. Mm-hmm. And Meryl Streep is the, you know, Anna Wintour.
Yes.
And she's styling a dress. And one of the women who works at the magazine holds up two almost identical belts, right? They're both like turquoise.
Yes.
And the girl holding them up is like, I know they're so different. It's hard to choose.
And she laughs.
And she laughs. And that's all Meryl needs to hear. I'm not even going to call her, I don't even remember what's her name in the...
I don't remember the character's name.
Miranda Priestley.
Yes, but she's based on...
She's Anna Wintour.
Yeah.
That's all she needs to hear. She's like, oh, okay. Do you think you're above all this?
Yeah.
Right. And then begins my lesson in the fashion industry and like how much I learned
from
this little speech, right? So she's like, you think that you're so, you know, intellectual that you don't need to worry about what you put on your body, right? So you went, so let's take this lumpy blue sweater that you're wearing.
Blue sweater.
And she goes, but what you don't realize is that what you're wearing is not blue. It's not turquoise. It's not lapis. It's cerulean. and like in 2002, Oscar de la Renta did a cerulean collection of gowns. And then she's like, and then who was it? I believe it was Yves Saint Laurent did a collection. And eventually it made its way down to the department stores. And eventually whatever tragic casual corner, you no doubt picked this sweater up out of a clearance bin.
Yeah.
And so she goes, and so you think you're like, you don't exist in this world when in fact... This sweater was chosen for you by the people in this room.
Right.
And it's just like, oh my God. And she's like, this color represents millions of dollars and thousands of jobs. And like, it is making the world go round, this fashion, this thing that you think is so frivolous. Mm. And like, what this speech achieves is, number one, like, she's the OG. She's the badass. She's like, you know, she's number one.
And it teaches you a lot about.
It teaches you so much about the design world. And it immediately shifts your allegiances. Like, you're with Andy, right? Like, you're like, oh, this is stupid shit. Like, who cares? And then you walk into this room and you're like, oh, I'm out of my depth. Number one, she has outmatched her intellectually. Like, she's a brilliant woman. Mm-hmm. Like, don't think that she's frivolous simply because she works in this industry. She has no idea what the magnitude of this industry is. Mm-hmm. And it really makes you like, oh, I'm dealing with a pro who has really earned her place. And... it's not necessarily the enemy, I think she is. She is a force to be reckoned with, certainly. But I feel like it immediately, you're like, I'm on her side. I don't want to be on your side anymore.
Interesting.
You're a dum-dum. I want to be with her.
See, I find that so interesting because I was going to ask you your feelings when you watch it because it always makes me unhappy when I watch it.
Oh, okay.
Because I feel like...
how complicit you are in this world.
And also, maybe it's her tone...
But she's certainly talking down to her.
Right, but it's almost like you're an ant under our shoe. Like, to me, when I saw the film for the first time, like, that made, like, obviously it's a moment for the character, a moment for the protagonist that she learned something.
And
But it made her more of a villain to me.
I think she's certainly a villain. I think she has moments of vulnerability throughout the film, Meryl Streep's character. But I think... it establishes her as not like the woman who's yelling for her coffee.
You know? Right.
She's like, she knows her shit and she's going to teach you about it. I love it. And I love all the memes that have recently popped up because Meryl Streep was at the Grammys.
Yes.
And there's a photo of her like very intensely talking to Beyonce, whose daughter is famously named Blue Ivy. And she has like her hand on Beyonce's arm and Beyonce genuinely looks like she's pulling her face back a little bit, like this white woman is talking to my face so close. And the caption is like, but what you don't understand is that your daughter's name is not Blue. It's not lapis. It's not turquoise. It's cerulean. And I was like, oh, it's just so good.
There was a little, I think at the Screen Actors Guild, there was a little reunion of the cast of that movie.
Oh, okay. I like that.
They presented an award together.
Also, just her... intonations are so good.
Well, I mean, she's obviously, I mean, she's like,
she is Meryl Streep.
She's incredible. She's
but like when she's starting the scene, she's also like doing her job while yes. she's
she's like, at one point,
I think we need a jacket here.
Yeah, like she's still like doing things while she's things talking
into this dress that she's styling and like putting this woman down.
Yeah,
like just effortlessly. And I love in the right in the beginning of the scene when she's like, "Why isn't anybody ready?" Like she just like drags out "ready."
Yeah.
Or when she says she changes her voice from being like this sort of deadpan kind of voice to like, and I actually think it's kind of comical. Like her voice goes up.
Yeah,
that's Meryl for you. It's just Meryl. Beautifully delivered, and in a movie that's otherwise sort of. Like a rom-com.
Yeah.
She got nominated for an Oscar. And I believe it's for this monologue. I mean, the overall performance. Monologue it's like is so strong. Moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
Stuff. All this stuff.
Incredible. Yeah.
That's a good one.
I'll do another TV show. This is from Star Trek.
Okay.
Season 2, episode 20, Return to Tomorrow from 1968. Mm-hmm. This is a fairly short one.
Yeah.
I can actually read the whole thing. It what people like about so the episode is they go onto a planet and they meet these three entities that are sort of disembodied and they're kind of like living in these like big glowy balls, but they're basically disembodied and they are so far advanced us but they ask like, can we borrow your bodies for a little while, and then we'll use your bodies to make robot bodies for us, and we've got to do it because we're just so much advanced from you. And and there's a meeting between like everyone on the ship with Kirk and Bones and Spock and Scotty and this scientist she's not in there. This is like the only episode she's in, and they're deciding like whether you do it and is it a trick? Is it worth it? Is it the doctor's like, it's really dangerous when they're in your body. Like your blood pressure goes they can't be in your body for that long.
Yeah.
And then Kirk's thing is they used to say, and imagine the overacting of fucking the great William Shatner. They used to say if man could fly, he'd have wings, but he did fly. He discovered he had to. Do you wish that the first Apollo mission hadn't reached the moon, or that we hadn't gone to Mars and then the nearest star? That's like saying you wish you still operated with scalpels and sewed your patients up with cat guts like your great-great-great-great-grandfather used to. I'm in command. I could order this. But I'm not, because Dr. McCoy is right in pointing out the enormous danger potential in any contact with life and intelligence as fantastically advanced as this. But I must point out that the possibilities, the potential for knowledge and advancement is equally great. Risk. Risk is our business. This is what a starship is all about. That's why we're aboard her. You may dissent without prejudice. Do I hear a negative vote? What people like, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, during this monologue, they show two reaction shots of McCoy, and it is the same reaction shot. Yeah. He's just like eyebrows raised, looking horrified the whole time.
What people like about it is it's the ethos of Star Trek. He perfectly...
To boldly go.
Yeah, he perfectly explains, this is probably not even a great idea. This is dangerous. We're coming into contact with something far above our ability to even imagine. But let's take the risk anyway, because that's literally what we're here doing.
Right. It's for the purpose of exploration, right?
Right. Well, yeah. How are we going to not take this risk? That's literally our risk is our business.
Mm-hmm. Risky business.
Yes.
And that was the prequel to Risky Business.
And yes. So it's, and there's a lot of little monologues all throughout Star Trek, a lot from everyone. But it is a good one because and then the music swells, the Star Trek theme. So it's like they knew this is like, oh, he's like explaining what this is. He's explaining Star Trek. So it's a very cool moment. Risk.
It really gets to the ethos of it, right?
Is our business.
Risk is our business. I got to say, though, his delivery was giving me so much Trump.
Yeah. You think Trump modeled
himself?
He's like,
your great-great-great-grandfather. And he's like throwing his hands around. I was like, oh my God.
I always love in Star Trek when they insult reality because they're so far above us.
Oh, they're operating with scalpels. Like, that's what we're still doing.
Fucking animals.
What?
Yeah, we don't have magic things that just fucking make you not sick anymore.
Oh God. Yeah, I know. I always hate that because I'm like, but we're doing that.
Yeah. You're a butcher.
You're a butcher. What are you doing to these people? It's like, oh, God.
Yeah. And it, you know what? I should say, it's worth noting that it does work out. Only one of the three is bad.
Uh-oh.
And wants to, like, keep the human body.
Oh, no.
The other two aren't and were genuine in what they were asking.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes it works out.
Star Trek, folks.
Yeah. That's what happens. All right. I am going to do the, I think it's the only monologue in Finding Nemo. It's another short one. And when I first saw the film, because it came out, I was like a young adult.
Yeah.
You know, I was starting college.
It's very short.
But it's The Power of the Performance by a person I consider a non-actor.
I think it's a person I consider a complete, total trash garbage person.
Who is also, has been revealed, a not nice person.
Yeah, a garbage person.
Not in the least. So it's performed by Dory, played by Ellen DeGeneres. And it's at the sort of the end of their journey together. Yeah. And Dory is neurodivergent. She suffers from short-term memory loss. And throughout the film, she really doesn't have any serious moments.
Yeah.
Until this moment. And it's always played for laughs, her memory loss. And, you know, it's like a funny running gag throughout the film. And after this tragic thing. So basically, Marlon, who's played by Albert Brooks brilliantly,
yeah,
believes he has witnessed his son die. Mm-hmm. And is now like parting ways with Dory because he's just so devastated. And she is basically begging him, like, please don't go. Like, yeah. I remember things better with you. And then she starts struggling to remember this thing that she's been remembering while they've been together. And then, like, her voice is breaking throughout. Like, it's
very desperate. It's very desperate
and heartbreaking. And then there's one point when her voice gets so small.
Yeah.
And she's like, please. Like, it's just this tiny little please. And she's like, I don't want to forget. The coda to that is that his line is devastating. He's like, I'm sorry, but I do. And it's like, oh. But her performance gets me almost every time. Mm. And I think it's a brilliantly read monologue by a person who is not an actor. Like, I know she was in, like, she's the star of Mr. Wrong. And we all love that film.
I mean, yeah, it's a classic. Did I see it in the theater with my brother and my mother? Yes.
I had a bootleg of it, which I did not choose.
I heard that they only released bootlegs of it.
Only released on bootleg. I watched it twice and I was like, I don't want to watch this one. And I used to, like, I had tapes I wore out.
Yeah.
Not Mr. Wrong, sadly. And I know she had her own sitcom.
Right.
But I don't consider her an actor.
Right.
She's a comedian. I liked her stand-up comedy. She's a show host. I thought she did a wonderful job.
She does a great job.
It's a really strong performance. And I remember, like, the making of on the DVDs, like, the crew and the cast and, you know, everybody producing the film was like, she floored us. Like, everyone was in tears. Like, we couldn't believe that we got this out of her, right? Like, this little heartbreaking moment. And then I think it's really what catalyzed them to do a whole movie about
Finding Dory. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's really great. It's basically someone saying, like, I'm better with you, so please don't leave me. Yeah,
please don't leave me. You make me the best version of me.
Yeah.
Right? And it's spoken between a non-romantic couple, right?
Yeah.
This is a platonic couple, and it continues to be platonic in the next film. Yeah. They are just paired. They truly love each other.
Yeah.
You know, they are friends. They are, like, they are these soulmates. They're these journeying companions. I loved it. I love that about the film.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the beginning of Finding Dory where she's a little kid.
Oh,
it's the cutest shit ever.
When I tell you, that makes me weep.
Like, how innocent and precious it is.
How beautiful she is. She's just like this pure little soul.
Hi, Daddy.
Oh, it breaks my heart.
No, I'm not Daddy.
I know.
Okay, Daddy.
The parent, I love, it's, what is it, Diane Keaton and
Eugene Levy.
It's so good. It breaks my heart that was her life. Her life was looking for them until adulthood, until she found Marlon. The montage kills me because it's like she's looking through the ocean, never stops until she bumps into Marlon. And then that makes the monologue at the end of this film like so much more heartbreaking because it's like she finally found something that wasn't like a journey. Like she wants to be with him because it's the only thing she knows outside of her parents.
Yeah.
So sad.
Yeah.
So sad. Yeah.
Well, that's a really good choice. That's awesome.
I love that one. There's a few good Pixar ones to choose from, like Buddy's monologue from Incredibles. There's Jason Lee's really good at that. There's Ego's review of at the end of Ratatouille.
I have some honorable mentions.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I just have like one honorable mention. But
I've got three.
Oh, okay.
Because they all kind of don't count. So my next one, and this is one that I'm really fudging with the rules here, because it's basically a dialogue. It's a dialogue scene, is from Psycho.
Yeah.
From 1960, screenplay by Joseph Stefano.
No, when I saw Psycho, I thought it was going to be I Wouldn't Hurt a Fly, like the end.
No, it's the scene.
She Wouldn't Hurt a Fly.
Where Anthony Perkins,
And Janet Leigh
are, they're having their little like dinner. He brings her a sandwich, mm-hmm. and she has, it's a big scene for her too, because in seeing how desperate and sad his life is, she decides to go back mm-hmm. and give him the money. She like decides right there and then to stop running and then dies.
Yeah. And it's also almost like a flirtation at first, but then it goes sour almost immediately. Yeah.
And it's Hitchcock. So it's beautifully staged. You know, mm-hmm. he's surrounded by these mm-hmm. birds that mm-hmm. he has stuffed because that's his hobby.
There's a shift in shots in the composition that's so brilliant that I've seen this movie a bunch of times. I love Psycho. It's like really in my top 10. Like I truly love this movie. But when he is talking about like his mom and how he's so put upon, he is the prey of the owl.
Yeah.
And then when it shifts after she suggests he put her in a home.
Someplace. Yeah.
All of a sudden, he's no longer shot by that angle and he is equal with the crow who is a predator. Like he is now dangerous.
Yes.
It's so brilliant.
Yeah. It's filled with, I mean, just classic lines too. Like, you know, do you have any friends? Well, a boy's best friend is his mother.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We all go a little mad sometimes.
Yeah.
You're right. It's this dance where he sort of has no power, but then kind of turns on her and mm-hmm. begins to have power.
The whole time his like the tense muscle in his cheek is going. It's such a great choice.
He says, people never really run away from anything. I think that we're all in our private traps, clamped in them, and mm-hmm. none of us can ever get out. We scratch and we claw, but only at the air, only at each other. And for all of it, we never budge an inch. And then she says, sometimes we deliberately step into those traps, and he goes, I was born in mine. Mm-hmm. I don't mind it anymore. I mean, you learn so much about this character just mm-hmm. in this moment. And then she says, like, wouldn't it be better if you put her someplace? And that's when he gets mad. Mm-hmm. When he's like, you mean an institution? A madhouse? People always call a madhouse someplace, don't they? Put her someplace. What do you know about caring? Have you ever seen the inside of one of those places? The laughing, the tears, the cruel eyes studying you? My mother there? It's really, I think, the centerpiece of that whole movie. Mm. More than the shower scene. And the shower scene is almost like the next beat.
Yeah.
It's not the very next thing that happens, but she leaves and goes to take a shower and he kills her.
Yeah.
But it's like also...
Do you think he's always going to?
No, I don't.
No?
Because, first of all, I think in that scene, he's desperate for any kind of interaction. He's like crying out for anything. I think because he's interested in her, he peeps on her. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very Freudian. I think he gets excited mm-hmm. and then to supplement it, he kills her.
Right.
Like that. That's why I always.
I mean, we don't know because it's a movie made at the time it was made, but maybe he experiences release from that.
Well, I'm going to say what I don't like about the remake is when he's looking at her, he's jerking off mm-hmm. and you kind of see him climax. And that changes everything to me because that means he kills her out of regret. But that's not what Hitchcock. Hitchcock is all about repression. Mm-hmm. Hitchcock is all about you don't finish the act. Mm-hmm. So to me, I always felt like, no, even if he's jerking off, he doesn't finish.
He has to penetrate her.
The climax is the murder.
Right, yeah. He has to penetrate her.
Yeah.
Somehow.
Yeah. I mean, the I've read the book too, and the big change that the book is not nearly as good as the film because in the book he's very loathsome, whereas the thing that Hitchcock suggested that the writer did, which makes it brilliant, is Norman Beach should be sympathetic. Like, you should care about him. And that makes it so much deeper.
Those big brown puppy eyes.
Right. And later on, we found out that he was a closeted man and he never could really be out in his public life. And so I think he brings a lot of that being closeted and not being able to be his true self to the role. Yeah, I think it's incredible.
It's a great performance in a great film. And yeah. I love her performance too.
And there's other good monologues in it. I mean, Arbogast, the detective, when he is interrogating Norman, I mean, that's all good too. When he's like, he basically traps him and he's like, well, see, that's the thing. You just told me that you don't remember what happened last night. And then you said this. And then Norman's like, you know what? I don't want to talk to you anymore. And like, he freaks out. Like, there's a lot of really good conversations in it. Yes.
It's a great film. So great. Go out and see it, kids, if you haven't.
Yeah.
All right. So the next one, we talked about this monologue a little bit when we did our Matrix series.
Yes, we did.
So this is the famous red pill, blue pill.
You're such a red piller.
Red pilled. I mean, that's the thing we talked about. Like, how this is so memed in the culture that to be red-pilled is to it means something completely different.
Yeah, now it means like
you're anti-woke, you know, the real truth, whatever that may be.
Right.
Like, meanwhile, this is a film series created by two trans women. Like, what does this all mean?
Yeah. And then, like, the suffix pilled becomes like anything, like, oh, I'm really gamer pilled.
I've been pilled. So this is the moment when Neo finally meets Morpheus, who he's been, you know, trying to find throughout the course of the beginning of the film. And it's such an iconic scene. It's beautifully shot. It's beautifully composed. Like, it's like got that green sheen to it. There's a storm happening in the background. And, you know, Morpheus is in his long leathers and his shiny, shiny reflective little glasses.
Yes.
Lawrence Fishburne is just pitch perfect here. He's great.
This is the scene. I mean, this is like the iconic.
This is the iconic Morpheus. Like, this is who he is, right? He is the game master, if you will. He holds the keys to everything. And he's sort of explaining, like, I know why you're here. I know why you've been looking for this. Like, you know something's wrong with the world. Like, you can feel it. And I think this is sort of speaking to the ennui of the 90s. So I think a lot of people watching this are sort of feeling the same way.
Yeah.
But of course, in the narrative of the film, there really is something wrong with the world. Right. This is the philosophical answer, like, the MTV generation was like looking for this whole time. And it's like, it's the Matrix. Like, the Matrix is the answer. And like, no one can tell you what it is. You have to see it for yourself.
And he gives him a choice.
Yeah.
You could just go right back to sleep.
Mm-hmm. He's like, if you take the blue pill. Because then it's like he presents the two pills in his hand. And it's a great iconic shot. You see his hands reflected in his glasses.
One or the other. Right.
In front of Neo. But there's two Neos. So there's only one hand in each pill.
It doesn't make real physical sense.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. Because there's a Keanu Reeves in each.
Yeah.
But it's showing like the two paths that he could potentially
take.
And
he evokes the Alice in Wonderland imagery of it all.
Yeah. He says the red pill. It's like, you'll see how far this rabbit hole goes.
Yeah.
It's a great scene.
Hillary Clinton eats babies. I knew it. Joe Biden is a puppet controlled
lizard people.
Yeah.
It's all of that. I mean, he shows them all of that stuff. But it's just, I feel like it's the most iconic scene in the movie.
For sure.
Yeah.
In
the series.
Maybe the most iconic scene in the 90s.
In the 90s, right? Like, it's just this great piece
the
90s. Of pop culture.
Yeah.
It is, you know, it's what the 90s culminated in. This scene. So I think for that reason, even though it's also a little bit of a dialogue scene, but Keanu Reeves doesn't have too much dialogue.
Yeah.
It just gets to the crux of like what this is all about, what this series is all about, and like what we were doing in the 90s.
Well, you know what it is? It's like the way I thought of it. When we were putting together the episode, was like, if it's, you know, there's dialogue where people are just responding to each other, but if it's a moment where someone's expressing an idea or expressing a feeling through what they're saying, even if someone's reacting to it or asks them a question that prompts them, to me, that's still a monologue. Also, I'm not an actor, but I imagine from an actor's point of view, when you look at something that's like 3 pages long, like that's a fucking monologue.
That's a monologue.
And whether also, somebody says something, like, I got to know all that shit.
I also, it feels like whoever has all the power in the scene, right? Yes. Like, he's holding all the power. He's almost like a hypnotist or, you know, he's so mesmerizing in the scene. Like his voice, how he's
and it, when you first
maintaining
watch it,
eye contact the whole time.
Right. And when you first watch it, you don't know who he is, what he is. Is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy? He's such a mystery.
Right. He's like the wizard, right? Even though it's like rabbit hole, it also has this Wizard of Oz element to it. You know, red, ruby red, and then everything else is green.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, absolutely.
It's got all this stuff. And
Go back and listen to our Matrix episodes.
It's a good series. It's a good series of films. I mean, the ideas are good.
They were playing 4 in the theater recently, and I was like, do I dare?
Go see it?
Do I dare?
You know what? I think the ideas are stronger than the films as a grouping of films. But I think the first one is still
great.
The
first one is the best one.
Yeah.
Because it's just philosophical enough. Mm-hmm. And it's just action enough. It's just enough of all the formula.
Yeah.
And then in 2 and 3 and 4, it just fucking... And
it kind of went
like
a little
4
wild.
More because 4 at least is just like, let's be more bananas. Let's go back a little... let's like be less military and go back more to like silly bullshit.
Yeah.
but I mean, none of them are the first one. The first one's really the real deal.
Mm.
All right, let me give you some honorable mentions before I say my last one. So, like I said, a lot of these don't really count. The voiceover from The Haunted Mansion. I mean,
welcome,
talk about
foolish mortal.
Yeah, talk about shit I quote every day.
Wow. That's something Peter quotes every day.
Really?
And he also says it's foolish Morton, like a man named Morton.
Foolish
like Morton Downey Jr.,
oh,
I imagine.
Morton.
Foolish Morton.
Foolish Morton. I mean, but it is eloquent. And just, you know, like your pallor, you know, the language of it, I think, is so rich. Mm. And really, it holds the thing together. The whole ride is, I mean, it's obviously this visual, you know, immersive thing. But that monologue, that dialogue is what holds the whole thing together.
Yeah, the narrative relies on it.
And it brings you through it.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, there was going to be like a crow or a bird that was like supposed to be him. Mm-hmm. But then they were like, we don't need that. Just like the voice is disembodied.
Yeah.
Did you see the new movie, by the way?
I did.
When the bird flies and scares Danny DeVito, was like, did you all know that was alive?
That movie has its moments.
It's good. It's much better than I thought it would be.
Mm.
It's still not the
much
one I would make.
Different. It's so different. Like, I would never make that as the Haunted Mansion movie,
right.
But I was happy to see
it. But unlike the first Haunted Mansion movie, they at least do the fan service. They give you all of the things. Even to the point where when they go to that second house, it looks like the Florida mansion.
So cool.
Yeah.
I thought that story was sort of odd.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But otherwise, I like the details. I did like the details.
It's a good... I enjoy it.
I feel like he was like a Ghostbuster, basically.
Yeah.
Like he wanted to prove that ghosts existed or didn't exist.
And even like things like... They tie in the shit that they tell you like to not take pictures. Like when you take pictures, it upsets them.
Mm-hmm.
Like they put that in the movie. So another one... Honorable mention is Patton Oswalt's filibuster from Parks and Rec.
Oh, man.
Which not all of it is in the show, but you can find it all online.
The time gem, the mind gem. He goes into all the Infinity Wars.
Oh, my God. Yeah, he basically... and he improvised it. They said, like, the joke was, you know, you're filibustering at a town meeting and you just say whatever you want. So he decides to, like, pitch a movie that's, like, Star Wars... crossing over with Marvel, and then like if some
the round of applause he got at the end of that tape
because he just keeps going and going and going. He just keeps going.
It's really
so long, and he's just coming up with it. And you know, and then you've got like Amy Poehler, like those franchises don't even match. And like she's just like feeding him shit. Like and the whole thing, it's so long. It's not. It's like 10 minutes. It would be like most of the episode, but it's really good. And then the last one is Obi-Wan's message to the Jedi after Order 66, it's something that's canon in Star Wars now because it appears in cartoons, it appears in video games, I think it's appeared in some books. In Episode 3, you see him go to make the message, but why show something interesting?
Mm-hmm.
And have you ever seen it in any of these iterations?
I don't think I
have, no. It's great because it's very sad and he's like, This is Obi-Wan Kenobi. We have been betrayed by the clones and by the Emperor. Wherever you are, stay where you are. Hide. Don't come back here. Because if you come back here, they're going to kill you. Run away. We've lost.
Mm.
But then the really cool part that like, get your missy out of it, he goes, one day a new hope will emerge.
Mm.
So that's honorable mention.
My honorable mention is the America Ferrera Barbie monologue.
Which one? You can't, as a woman, you can't do
the
right.
Yeah, a woman, you can't do this. Yeah, like, you're too, and it's all the contradictions of womanhood. And I love how it caps off when it's like, and if all these people can have all of this rage at a doll that represents the idea of a woman, imagine what it is to be an actual woman.
Right.
Like, I know people who cried. Like, yeah. I know people who,
that movie's,
you know,
much
really
smarter than people give it credit for.
I think she got her Oscar nomination for that monologue.
Because
I also think it's very well performed.
Yes, it is. She's great. That's a great, I think Barbie is actually going to last a long time.
I think so, too. I think it's one of these touchstone films that people will keep coming back to. I don't think it's going to sweep the Oscars.
No, it's not.
But I think it will.
But it shows something that it couldn't be ignored.
Anatomy of a Fall, or like whatever movie people like for the Oscar this year.
Zone of Interest. It's got to be a Holocaust movie.
Yeah.
Although
to be fair, that is a really interesting concept.
I haven't seen it yet. I'm sure I've heard it's amazing. Yeah. But
it's not like, I'm not going back to it like Barbie.
Barbie was like a moment.
Yeah,
like,
Barbie's a moment.
Being in the theater, I saw Barbie 3 times, and every time I was in the theater, it was like, this feels like something happening.
Mm.
All right, so my last one is from the movie The Great Dictator from 1940.
Yes.
And this is
Charlie This really Chaplin. Feels like a Charlie Chaplin vanity move.
It's the first time his character speaks ever. So Charlie Chaplin obviously was a silent film performer, and he dragged his heels making sound. Like, one of his best silent movies is City Lights, and that was done in the sound era.
Uh-huh.
It even begins with like a scene making fun of sound where people are talking and it sounds like wah, 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 like making fun of it.
Mm-hmm.
And if The Great Dictator is, it's like a Prince and the Pauper story where there's a character he's not called Hitler, but he's basically Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
Played by Charlie Chaplin.
Who had the mustache before Hitler.
Right. And then Charlie Chaplin plays a version of himself, the little tramp character.
He's like, how weird is it that
Jew
we have the same mustache?
Yeah. Or when he's revealed that he's a Jew. And they switch places.
Yeah.
And he has to like give a speech at the end and he doesn't want to do it. He's scared.
And in the meantime, Hitler's like falling over railroad tracks, just being silly.
Yeah.
Swinging his cane around.
And he doesn't speak, even with other people speaking, like he doesn't really speak in the movie. And then he like takes that moment in front of everyone to like give this huge speech about democracy. And
it's so hippy dippy.
Yeah.
He's like, the kindness and caring of gentleness and love and caring. And, you're like, oh, I didn't think that's what your voice would sound like. First of all.
Right, it's not at all.
It was
all
like the Rick and Morty, like when he took off the helmet. And it's like, oh, I didn't think he'd have a mustache. Like, that's how I feel about Charlie Chaplin's voice. I was like, first, I did not
hat on a hat.
I knew you were British, but I didn't know you were British.
Right. Right. What's extraordinary to me is this movie's made in 1940.
Much later than I thought.
Really?
I just think of him as the 30s, and that's
I'm saying in terms of the war,
you're just in the middle of
this. This is before Pearl Harbor. I mean,
you're not even involved as an
this
American.
This is early on.
Yeah.
I mean, the reaction in America to this movie was not like, oh, yeah, he's giving it to Hitler. It was like, oh, this guy's a communist, and the FBI is going to start watching him now.
Yeah.
But the thing that people say I think it's well acted, even though obviously it's, you know, like corny of its time.
Right. It's that old timey acting.
And I do think I think it's well written. And I just feel like after a huge career of being like the most famous silent film actor, like the moment he speaks is this like fuck fascism moment. Like that's what he chooses to do. And Hitler liked Charlie Chaplin and was a fan of Charlie Chaplin. And like, supposedly he screened the movie more than once, but like was like, we don't talk about it. We can't, like, he hurt Hitler. And it's, you know, like he was, it was early. It was 1940. Like, he's ahead of his time, like, doing something like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is, you know, Springtime for Hitler and the producers is like the 60s. Like, it's,
yeah, to make much fun later. Of, this is like, know, Hitler's arguably alive. Hitler's, the most,
yeah,
you know, powerful individual.
Yeah. So
at the time. Yeah.
That's my last one.
Very similarly, my last one is Dr. Evil's monologue from the first Austin Incredible. Powers film. And the one I sent you actually has, it's like lines that were cut that like are not in the monologue. So I was like, that's weird. I didn't like, that's not the version. The regular version is what you're thinking of. So in the film, Dr. Evil has a son named Scott. In the midst of this plot where, you know, he's trying to destroy the world or he's holding the world hostage, he takes the time to go to a father-son support therapy group that is being moderated by Carrie Fisher.
Yes.
I forgot
she was in that.
She's brilliant in this and also knows a thing or two about having an evil dad.
Yeah.
So there you go.
And she's and being in support groups.
And being in support groups. That's right. So this immediately became like, this was an oft quoted. This was quoted to death film.
Yeah.
When it came out, right?
But so, they quoted all the wrong things.
Right. But, you know, do I make you horny, baby? Yeah. Shagadelic, all this shit. You know, everybody had an Austin Powers blockbuster standee in their house.
He'd make it seem claims like he invented this question mark.
But this monologue. So Carrie Fisher says, please tell us about yourself. The details of my life are inconsequential. It's the delivery.
Yeah.
It's the words are so strange.
Yeah.
And nothing about his life makes sense. And I mean, I can almost do, I was able to do it word for word at one point. Bill had a poster of the monologue.
Incredible.
Like, they sold posters of this monologue.
Incredible.
My father was a relentlessly self-improving boulangerie owner with low degree narcolepsy and a penchant for buggery.
A penchant for buggery.
My mother was a 15-year-old prostitute named Chloe with web feet. It's just my father would make outrageous claims like he invented the question mark. Sometimes he would accuse chestnuts of being lazy. I'm not reading, by the way. I just want to listen
She's
and know
reading.
That I'm not reading.
It's so good.
He had the sort of general malaise that only the genius possess and the insane lament, which is a beautiful line.
That's
in
gorgeous.
The midst of nonsense. Like, he's like, my childhood was typical. Summers in Rangoon. Luge lessons. In the spring, we'd make meat helmets. I don't know what that means.
Is
it a helmet made of meat or is it a helmet for the meat?
I think it's made. To me, I see made of meat.
Helmet made of meat, right?
But
yeah,
it's one of my favorite lines because it's not eloquent. It's just
we made meat helmets. Right. Yeah, like when I was insolent, I was put in a burlap sack and beaten with reeds. Pretty standard. It's like when I was 14, when I was 12, I received my first scribe. He was given a scribe?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
A scribe?
Yeah.
Unless it has a second definition that I don't know about. Isn't it just a person who writes?
Whose job
for
is
you?
To write, yeah.
At 14, a Zoroastrian named Vilma ritualistically shaved my testicles. There really is nothing like a shorn scrotum. It's breathtaking. I suggest you try it. And then it ends because Carrie Fisher's like, we really need to stop here.
Yeah,
and it's just so good. And for all the youngins out there,
movie's very good.
The first Austin Powers movie is very strong. This is my favorite part in it. Please, you know, if you're going to watch something very weird, just weird. Yeah. It's just that weird comedy that was everywhere in the late 90s and continues to today.
Yeah.
Like, it's, you know, Tim Robinson. Like, we love that shit. It's just so weird. And I love it so much. And I loved it for being weird.
Yeah. I became soured
on Rangoon.
I became soured with Mike Myers because I didn't like really the third one and Yeah. Got, like, he's done a lot of kind of garbage lately. But that first one, I think, is, like, a really, like, solid
comedy. It's a solid comedy. Movie.
It's really good.
And he was coming off of a lot of pretty good movies at the time. Yeah. So, you know, there was, obviously, Wayne's World and So I Married an Axe Murderer. It's got his, got its fans. I know, yeah, Bill is, too. I think your brother is as well. So he was coming off of, like, a series of pretty strong films. And then I would say he kind of went, well, there's Shrek, I guess. The Shrek franchise is huge.
I mean, that's probably what made him a gajillionaire.
Yeah. But after that, he kind of, you know, his films where he's a person in them didn't really do much. But this was a real
shining
moment.
I think after Orson Powers, it became a thing of, like, I have to play multiple people.
Yeah.
And
why do comedians feel the need to do that? Is it vanity?
Yes.
Yeah.
And also, like, look at me. I'm a chameleon. I can do so many things. Look at me. I'm all the clumps.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, I feel like this episode has been a real, has really captured the ethos of PCMC.
And because, certainly you and really are things that we're into, right?
Yeah. And we've really given people quite a smorgasbord of stuff to choose from.
Yeah.
Because this is, it's all.
Do you think anyone's ever performed? Because you know how, like, actors in acting school have to perform monologues? Yes. Do you think anyone's performed the Dr. Evil monologue at, like, the Stella Adler Academy?
No.
At Juilliard?
No. But I bet people do the Quint one.
Oh, I'm sure they do Quint.
All the time.
Now, I've heard tell that in the Broadway show, The Shark is Broken.
Yeah.
Robert Shaw's real life son, who plays Robert Shaw, does the Quint monologue and just gets it, which is weird because you're seeing like a DNA clone.
Yes, he looks a lot like him.
Perform this in front of you, in front of your very eyes.
It's a weird. I
don't know that it could have the lightning that, you know.
No, no way, because it's also a different context. It's a different thing. Yeah, then it's also like. To bring it back to that, it's also like morning time right after it too. Like, so it's like, how long was that
monologue? What is he talking about? They were in the middle of the night. It is sort of like the twilight of dawn. You can kind of see there's like a blue line in the background when they do the establishing shot. But then it's just the daytime.
Yeah. I mean, his whole performance is like the best performance ever. Like the way like he plays something is cool. Like, put the fire out, Chief.
Put the fire out, would you, Chief? Ah. I love it. I love it.
Jaws is a good movie, hot take. This has been PCMC. I'm Mike Bongiorno. I was joined by Janine Gagliardi. Oh,
something I didn't mention about the Quint thing.
Please.
A ton. If you're watching the YouTube like clip, most of the comments are like, you know, any modern director would feel the need to cut to a flashback. And he never cuts. He just lets him talk.
I disagree with that, but I think
that's the you would common...
cut to reactions.
Okay. I mean, you do see Hooper react, but it's only because he's still in the frame.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You see Roy Scheider.
But
Roy
I feel like when he really gets into the meat of it,
it's just getting closer to him.
Trained on him.
Yeah, yeah. I do agree that they would, we rely on the flashback too much.
Well, I mean,
we don't just let people talk. But we don't have a bunch of Robert Shaws running around.
Because the events are not, if you saw a flashback, it would be saying the events are important.
Right.
When what's important is, his
trauma.
Experience
yeah,
of
yeah.
it. And it's also more effective to hear him talk about it and you imagine what the situation must be like.
Right. Your imagination is worse than anything they're going to show you.
Right. I mean, he's like, you know, how many, I forget the numbers, like 100 of us went into the water, 3 came out.
He's like 100, he's like, I don't know how many sharks, maybe 1,000 sharks. They average like 100 men. They average 6 per hour.
Oh, can you imagine? Right? They average 6 per hour.
And he says a young pilot, younger than Mr. Hooper here, flew down low and saw us. And then he's like, that's the moment I was afraid the most. He's like, when I was waiting for my turn to be picked up. Like, he wasn't going to make it out.
Right.
Right? Like, what if it gets me now while I'm so close to getting out?
That's what makes his death so interesting because there's something in his – he fights it, but there's something about him where he's like, this is it. I knew this was how it was going to fucking happen.
I know. Or it's just like it's always been coming for him.
Yeah. And then Jaws 2, they've got that scene where they're water skiing. That's pretty cool.
Hey, I remember the fashion show over the pool and the shark somehow ends up there too. So is that number 2? It might be number 3.
I have no idea.
Who knows?
It all kind of blends together.
Yeah.
Janine, thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for your monologues.
I had a few. Thank you for having me.
Speaking of monologues, soon I'll be doing, the new Ghostbusters movie comes out, and I'll be doing another Just Me Alone episode.
Really?
It's too intimate. It's too, like, I did a Me Alone episode for Ghostbusters Afterlife.
Okay.
It's just me. It's just got to be just me. Just me and my thoughts.
Get Peter in there. Get Peter in there.
I wouldn't mind.
He'd be like, eating the microphone. I want to be a Ghostbuster when I grow up.
I'm like, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your contribution.
I agree. I too. Me as well. We end every episode by saying,
go bye-bye.